Wally and the Beeve, Betty, Bud, Kitten, Adam, Hoss, and Little Joe. Some of us are old enough to remember these families. Some of us just watch Nickelodeon. But for those who can remember those TV shows, those days seem like a long, long time ago in another galaxy far, far away, don't they? It's the kind of thing that Naomi and Winona Judd call the good old days, that your grandparents talk about, but it's about as distant as the Model T. Things are certainly different, aren't they? If you tuned into your television lately, if you noticed what family shows are like now, now you can find all kinds of alternatives. You can find families without any men in the household at all, several women raising several children. Who knows who belongs to who? You can have families without any women in them, or you can have different men. And father doesn't know best anymore. As a matter of fact, the man may not even be the father of any of the kids. And we're moving into a world, whether you're aware of it or not, where there are legal issues coming up in the courts as to whether parents even need to be of opposite genders. There's all that kind of gender confusion going on. Father doesn't know best anymore. He's usually an idiot, to be honest with you. Usually it's the alien life form in the house that's really got the wits, or the butler Belvedere or whatever. Explain all of that to Grandma next time you see her. Now, it might seem curious that in a series on The Good Life, we even talk about family, because we're also in a time where we felt a great deal of ambivalence about that, and I'm sure you are aware of that. Nobody would quarrel with the other themes that we've had so far: success, affluence. We're going to talk about fame and prestige, but family? Family sticks out like a sore thumb because it looks like an obstacle to success, an obstacle to affluence, an obstacle to fame and prestige. It's just hard to project that cool, urbane manner when you have drooling, regurgitating, scrapping, and yelling kids hanging around your ankles. I was a little bit ahead of some of my peers who are just having young children now, but I remember in the late 70s they were dark days. I remember how unfavored you were if you went into certain pricey stores with kids. People looked at you with that sort of "how could you" look. I wasn't sure whether it's "how could I bring children into such a neat place" or "how could I just have children to begin with? The world's overpopulated," and all the rest. And they cost a lot. If you have too many of them, you can't get a vehicle which can carry them all, and even if you can, then you can't carry their friends. You can't afford them. It keeps you from buying that hot tub you always wanted. They put a real crimp in your date night. James Dobson says insanity is an inherited disease. You get it from your kids. That's the kind of environment in which we've been. But have you noticed, if you put your finger to the air, the breeze, there's been a slight shift in direction. In the mid-80s, we had a much publicized baby boomlet. Values began to swing back a little bit. It actually became chic to have children. Now, grant you, celebrities got all kinds of media attention. They didn't need to be married. The media simply looks at it with some amusement. Here you have two people, never have married, won't commit, but for the time being, they're raising this little child. People are having babies much later in life than they used to, before it's too late, despite their careers. And the Cosby showed us that you could be sort of urbane and cool, even if you had children. Today, in fashionable neighborhoods all across America, mothers are chuckling their babies, saying, "Gucci, Gucci, Gucci." More and more, people are feeling that the good life and the family life are not necessarily incompatible. And in that, I think they'd find in the Bible a resounding agreement. I'd like you to look with me this morning at Psalm 127. It's the classic passage. And if you're interested, Psalm 128, which follows on it, are the two pivotal psalms on the home that you can find in the Scriptures. This particular one begins out musing on the meaning and the value of life. What is success? How do you achieve it? How long does it last? Does it really satisfy? Those kinds of questions. It's written by somebody who I think is well qualified to ask the questions because he was a success in his field. In the area of kingship, Solomon stood out. In his day, there was no one that stood taller and higher than Solomon. He was a great king. He put Israel on the map. He made everybody in the international community sit up and take notice. More money, more buildings, more fame, more power, more knowledge, says the Bible, than anybody before him or since. So much so that today his name is proverbial with wisdom and success. So this man Solomon, who wrote this, this is the voice of experience. This is the voice of one who has been there in terms of success and affluence and fame and all the other things we're talking about, but he was also a father. And so the psalm begins with the two major preoccupations in life: building and conserving. Look at the first line. Unless the Lord builds the house. Again, unless the Lord watches over the city. Now, the house is the principal thing, isn't it? No matter what else we do, we may go to work and everything else, but we want a good house, or at least a good condo, or at least a good patio home. That's the American dream, is that I have my own piece of real estate and my own building that I can call mine. It's my castle. It's the center of gravity of my life. It's the anchor. It's the first thing that young couples go out and try to establish when they get married. The house is the first concern. But then he says, talks about building a city. And I think that speaks to all those cultural activities, endeavors in which people are engaged. Business deals. Engineering, research and development, production, manufacturing, marketing, artistic endeavors, hospitals, education, law enforcement, transportation. That degree you're earning in your part-time, maybe that part-time job that brings you some pocket change, maybe that high-fueled, super-octane job that promises to propel you to the very top of your chosen field and career, all of those things, I think, are encompassed in the idea of building a city. So we're all involved in that. He says, unless God's in it, he says, there's going to be a problem. But then he speaks of conserving. There's nothing more terrifying than failure unless it's succeeding and then failing. We've all heard stories of the person who made the big kill and then lost it all. The person that made his money in real estate in Austin and today is selling apples down on the corner. We are probably surrounded with those kinds of stories. There's always a danger that it could all be in vain, and this speaks to that. There's a sense in which, unless God is in it, we won't be able to hold on to it, you see. But there's another nuance or facet to the word vain, which I've touched on before, and it points to the idea of emptiness. Vanity, vanity, says the writer of Ecclesiastes. Do you know that book, a couple books after Psalms? The idea that unless God is in it, even if you succeed, it's not going to be satisfying. I got into what for me was a fascinating discussion with some street philosophers down at the auto garage last week. I spent a lot of my time there because I'm basically a philosophical type of person. And I let it out that someday, probably in another galaxy far, far away, I'm going to buy a new car. And they said, well, what do you want to get? And we got talking about it. And then a couple of these guys, grease under their nails and everything else, began talking ruefully. You had to be there. They were so ruefully said, oh, you get a new car and it's so neat, but boy, it doesn't last long at all. You had the feeling these guys had tried it, and not just once. It passes so quickly. It's so neat, but pretty soon all you're left is with the payments. There was an article in New York Magazine a while back called Why One Wonder Woman Packed It In. It tells about a lady named Susan. After she got her undergrad degree, she moved to New York. That's the center of the universe. We all know that. Determined to make it. She did 2 years of odd jobs before she finally broke through and became a production assistant for Family Circle magazine. Later that year, she married a journalist. Her combined incomes made them, quote, comfortable. That's code word for affluent. They were now comfortable at home, but something was missing in her career. Let me quote her. I was looking for something to sink my teeth into. I wanted to pick a ladder and move on it. Love it. Not long after, she quit Family Circle, was hired by a PR firm. Her salary doubled. Quote, it was fast, she says. Women were running everywhere. They talked faster. They moved faster. Her job was to manage accounts for Esquire and Cosmopolitan magazine. Life got consumed by the job. Quoting again, I picked up the signals. If you had a peaceful day, you were a loser. I was working 24 hours a day. It took it with me wherever I went. But you know, there was something about that adrenaline rush. She loved the challenge of it all. And then the pressure began to mount. Cosmopolitan withdrew its account. She was assigned another big client, but she broke her ankle. Did she take any time off? No, there's too much to be done. She received a large bonus and yet another large account to manage. She got to the place where she had a birthday dinner with her husband and she showed up late for her own appointment with her husband. She found that it was a relief when friends canceled out on appointments and her husband worked late and she didn't have to go home as early as she should have. She knew that. Holidays faded into the background. She kept working on business trips, canceled planned vacations with her husband. Can't you just feel that tension mounting and mounting and mounting? Now feast your eyes on verse 2. In vain, or it's empty if you rise early and stay up late. What do we try to do? What's the wrong solution to that tension? I'm going to take a time management seminar. I'm going to work smarter instead of harder. I'm going to get up a little bit earlier. I'm going to go to bed a little bit later. I'm going to do some of my work and read in the bathroom. I'm going to toil. See that word, toiling for food to eat? The word doesn't just mean laboring, doesn't just mean producing. It means toiling. There is a day-in grind to it. It becomes bitter and unsatisfying, and you discover the good life is bad-tasting. And not only that, there's no relief when you go to bed at night. He grants sleep to those he loves. The idea being, Solomon knew what it was like to be up late at night worrying. And that's what Susan did. She kept the promotion. She kept getting those promotions, but they led to increasing demands in her life. And as she neared the breaking point, she was offered another big account. Now she decided she was at the watershed. She was going to make that bold, courageous decision. She told them, I want to turn down that account. And they looked at her blankly, like, you can't be saying that. The decision has already been made by higher management. And she suddenly had that claustrophobic feeling, I'm trapped in a vicious cycle. Now, because I'm succeeding, I'm getting more and more put on me. The better I do, the more I'm given to do, so that it's just a matter of time until I break and they replace me with some new, fresh face. Maybe she needs an executive calendar planning system. She ordered one of those things. She couldn't face the thought of failure, but the insomnia began to keep her up at night, a chronic problem. She got another $5,000 raise, but she couldn't buy peace and freedom with it. So she says that she was on a shuttle back to New York City one evening, and she assessed her life. She was a successful PR agent, married to a successful journalist. She traveled with Hartman luggage. Sales girls knew her by name in the chic boutiques at which she shopped. She ate at places like the Quilted Giraffe and Le Zinc. Every 5 weeks, she had a $70 hairstyle by Chaz Frimolero. She had 4 Hermes scarves. Fresh flowers filled her homes. A bundle of cards, don't know how to pronounce this, fit smartly into a Louis something case. I only know Hebrew and Greek, not French. But it's a French word. Her body was toned by Nautilus. Her average monthly American Express bill totaled $1,500. She had recently been pricing a Rolex watch, a Barry Kieselstein cord belt, and a country house. Quote, again, I couldn't believe, she says, how sucked in I was. I felt I had blinked and it had happened. And then get this, at the end of the article, I wasn't the kind of friend I wanted to be. I wasn't the kind of wife I wanted to be. I was consumed, and I started to realize that, quote, having it all, end quote, was like a dog chasing his tail. I ended up having very little. And then I look at these verses in the Proverbs. They've been here for centuries. Things don't change, do they? He who brings trouble on his family will inherit only the wind. 15:27, a greedy person brings trouble to his family. Just those warnings over and over and over that if we get consumed with the quest for riches, we're going to bring emptiness and trouble on our family, and that's going to produce some misery. The first point that we've really established so far is that everything is not enough. We talked about that last week a little bit on affluence. Then I get the second point. Relationships matter more than riches. Because this psalm suddenly takes a rather startling shift, to my ears at least, in the modern 80s, coming up on the 90s. Suddenly shifts gears to the family. Sons, talking about these great grand cultural enterprises, suddenly talks about babies. It says sons are a heritage from the Lord. It's saying, in fact, there's a play on words that you can't get in the English, but the word builders in the Hebrew is the word bonim, and the word sons in Hebrew is banim. So if you were reading this, you couldn't help but notice the play on words. You have your bonim over here in their cultural enterprises, the grand schemes of life, and then you have the little bonims down here throwing up on the carpet. And this psalm is saying that, you know, it's right here in the regurgitation that the real life is to be found. Relationships matter more than riches. Now, it's not saying that those other things are unimportant. The Bible, and I said this last week on affluence, it's important that we grasp that God wants us to function in the marketplace. We're not supposed to hide in a corner until Christ comes back. We're to be absorbed in society and involved without being sucked into its false values. It's not that those things are unimportant, but that they are not all important. And by themselves, they're empty. And then it paints a picture here, instead of that stress-filled life, of a life of quietness and contentment, hearth and home, and all those kind of values that people are struggling to rediscover in their lives today after having thrown them out. Verse 3, let me show you some words that used to describe children. I think this is important. The next psalm talks more about wives and spouses, if you will. I'm not going to focus on that quite as much today. The focus here is on children. Of course, you don't really have those unless you have husbands and wives. Not supposed to. Something heritage means something bequeathed, something entrusted. A heritage from the Lord means the children are entrusted to us by God. Now, I know that some of you planned and some of you didn't, and some of us make mistakes and so on and so forth. But, you know, God is a God of mistakes. God, not that he makes mistakes, but he rules over them. He uses those things. Every child you've got, God is in that in some way. And think about the alternative. The alternative that some of us here are just freak accidents in the universe. Now, I know appearances can be deceiving. But what this is saying is that our children need to be received as an entrustment from the God. They don't really belong to us. One false value that we could fall into now as we go into the 90s with this cultural shift going on is that we could begin to look at children as our own little possession. You know, we had our dogs, we had our cars, we had our hot tubs. Now it's chic to have a kid. Look at mine. Pimple free. They become status symbol, and it becomes a selfish preoccupation. But if I recognize that this is property of the Lord and has been entrusted to me, if I really let that sink down into my value system, it's going to affect how I look at that child and how I treat him. One writer says, children are not tools to be used, but souls to be loved. God doesn't waste children or parents. Second word, in verse 3b, children are a reward from him. Just ask somebody who can't have children. It's funny how we spend all our time trying not to have them in inconvenient and embarrassing times, and then we discover we can't have them. Suddenly the world goes to pieces. Suddenly we're in those long lines waiting to adopt a child, but there aren't as many because we throw them out these days. They're discardable. Now we are going down trying to find out what we can do with the test tube. Now we're getting various counts on our body and everything else to see if we can somehow manage to have a child. And you know, when you find out, I've talked to a lot of people over the years. I know it doesn't always happen that way, but I've run into so many people who couldn't have children for years, and then boom, one day they had one. And you know what their first words were? Thank God. They just knew. They knew that they couldn't do it, and they just had a sense that God had smiled on them and provided them that child. We ought to look at every child that way. This is a reward, a gift from the Lord. We ought to look at the prize of kids instead of the price of kids. Third word, I like this one. They're like arrows in the hands of a warrior. Hi-ya. Now, I know we're a peace-loving people. I struggled, and I didn't come up with a satisfactory contemporary metaphor. If you were living back then, I mean, this was it, a really good arrow. You know, you had to spend a lot of time shaping those arrows and getting the feathers on just right and getting them balanced and getting them sharp. Arrows are hard to do, solid and strong so they don't break. And I'm told that archery is one of the most difficult sports to master, believe it or not. Now, children are like arrows. If we work at them and shape them, they can be tremendously powerful and effective. Children are like arrows in the sense that arrows are made to be sent, not just hoarded. And where children are to be shaped for a period of time and then sent out into the world, and you know, they expand our influence. They go places that you were never able to go. They go beyond your own particular talents. In fact, they go beyond your own particular lifetime. John Whitehead says, children are the living messages we send to a time we will not see. Isn't that nice? Let me quote you the cultural historian Will Durant, died a few years ago. Some of you may be familiar with him, but he made a comment that I really took to heart. He was talking about history, but I think it applies to families. Quote, civilization is a stream with banks. The stream is sometimes filled with blood from people killing, stealing, shouting, and doing other things historians usually record, while on the banks, unnoticed, people build homes, make love, raise children, sing songs, write poetry. The story of civilization is the story of what happened on the banks. Historians are pessimists because they ignore the banks for the river. Is that great? Real life takes place just on the back roads and the suburbs and the little houses out in the neighborhoods. It's not just the dramatic things that you read in the paper. I can't think of anything more disillusioning than to become a mayor, a governor, a president, and finding out how little power you really have to shape things. What you discover you really have to do is take polls and figure out where things are going anyway, and then look like you're in front of it. That's the key to leadership in most things. The real life is taking place, the little people in the little worlds. Do you know the Bible enough to know who Abraham was? He was the one God singled out way back in the first book, the book of Genesis. And he said that he was going to bless the whole world through Abraham. That sounds pretty great. Let me quote you James Strachan. Abraham was chosen to be a blessing to the whole earth, but his vocation was to begin to take effect in the simplest way. He was called to teach his household, who again would hand down the truth to their households, and his being a blessing to the world depended on his being a blessing to his own home. The most powerful impact you can have on the future is the impact you have through the only lives that have been entrusted to you to shape. And I wrestle with it just like you do. It's frightening to wake up some days and think, I'm not having an impact where it counts. And all these other awards and things, nobody will remember me. Remember the game of tens? Didn't we go through that a week or two ago? Who are the ten, named ten secretaries, cabinet secretaries under Reagan? Or Bush, for that matter? Didn't even know that? There's famous people. They're influential. You don't know who they are. It all fades so quickly. Families are also an investment in future security. Family is the first recourse in old age, before the government, before any other sort of a social institution, before all the health care plans. It's the family. When everybody else discards you, the family is supposed to be there. And the cycle is complete in sort of a poignant way. When we come into the world, we're completely dependent. We may not even be aware in a way that we can remember of who our parents are. And then we go through life and we get to the other end of the spectrum and we're old and we're still not aware of who our kids are. By some points, and yet they care for us. The ones who are dependent upon us are now the ones upon whom we depend. The Germans have a charming proverb, many children make many prayers, and many prayers bring much blessing. Folks, the real riches in life are relationships. And what relationships are better than family relationships? Those are the closest relationships. Those are the people we spend most of our time with. They're the people who are most alike. Every family is unique and takes on a life and quality all of its own. Robert Frost says, home is the place where when you have to go there, they have to take you in. There's a lot of profundity in that. Home is the place that you can always go back to and they can't turn you out. In some ways, loneliness is the hallmark of our age. We are surrounded by people who are looking for an identity, looking for who they are, some sense of community cohesiveness, grasping at straws, looking for lasting relationships. In a wedding a month ago, I quoted Erica Young from Ms. Magazine. Maybe you all noted it in your subscription. But let me read it to you. Oh, and Erica Young, do you remember her? Fear of Flying and other books, I only know. Quote, our society has had a decade and a half of experimentation with random sexual freedom. We have discovered that it is neither so very sexy nor so very free. My generation is disillusioned with sex as a social panacea. We look longingly at the marriages of our parents and grandparents and wonder how on earth they managed to stay best friends for so long, or even worst friends for so long. Now get this. But at least they had someone to read the newspaper with. She's done it all, tried it all, written about it, and comes full circle and says, you know, verses 3, 4, and 5 really make more sense. I don't know if she even knows those verses, but it's saying what she said. The problem is, if you wait to discover all these things by experiencing themselves in your own lifetime, you probably won't live long enough, or you may die early because of some of the foolish things you try. And there's so many things to learn that you'd have to live several lifetimes to do it. That's why we need some collective wisdom from the ages and some insight from God on how to live. One thing is for sure, the love of money and the quest for affluence can destroy relationships. And by itself, we talked about a legitimate place for affluence and stewardship last week, but by itself, it's not fulfilling. It's people that make the difference. Look at Proverbs down here, chapter 15, verse 17. Better a meal of vegetables where there's love than a fattened calf with hatred. And again, better a dry crust with peace and quiet than a house full of feasting with strife. Some of us know exactly what that means. Everything's not enough. Relationships matter more than riches. Thirdly, family. Don't leave home without it. Are you cultivating the family life that you have, or are you just discarding it and taking it for granted? Do you remember the story of the prodigal son? The prodigal son had a nice dad, a real irritating brother, and he began to look at all those constraints in his house. Did you ever read the birth order book? I read it because I sent a birthday card to my brother. I only had one brother. He was a little brother. And I sent it to him on his birthday a couple of years ago. It said, happy birthday, little brother. What did we get this year? I hear the younger siblings laughing. The older ones say, well, what's so funny about that? My brother howled. He howled so much it bothered me. And I went and got the birth order book to find out why. And as I read through it, I discovered that the The only real constant rule in birth order is that any sibling will do the opposite of what the person before him was doing. So this older brother of the prodigal was straight as an arrow, by the book, follow the rules, Achtung type of guy, up against the wall. He was joyless. He was stiff. He was severe. And the prodigal thought, who needs this? I'm getting out of here. I don't need this kind of stuff. And he decides, you know, I need to get away from town, this small town, this farm life, these country hicks. I need to go into the big city and be urbane and cool and read the New Yorker. You're going to think I have a thing about New York today, aren't you? Okay, Los Angeles. I remember feeling that way when I was 18. I didn't have any problems in life that wouldn't be solved by getting rid of mom and dad. Going to college was the day of redemption. And it was so shocking to discover somebody tied that little small town to the bumper of my car. I ran into people on campus that I'd gone to high school with who knew that I wasn't urbane and cool. And I discovered there were other problems and I had to call home at times and I couldn't quite get away from it. And this prodigal, in the same way, runs away from home, decides that life is beyond the boundary, over the fence, run away. That's where it's found. And he gets out there and he discovers instead that family is the only thing that lasts. You remember, the economy didn't last. It plummeted. Maybe he went to somewhere in Texas. And he found himself doing what for a Jew was one of the most degrading jobs in the world. He was feeding food to the swine, and they were eating better than he was. He only got the leftovers. Jews didn't hang around a lot of pigs, you see. Where are all those beautiful women that he used to tell him how cool he was? They were nowhere to be seen. Where are all those buddies and friends he used to party with all night? They were nowhere to be seen. Just the pigs. For that matter, where was all the money? That doesn't last, but family still lasts. He also decided that family is the only thing that counts. What are your last thoughts going to be in a hospital bed or on a highway after an accident or after you've been a victim of crime or you're in a falling jetliner? In those last moments, what do you think of? For me, the most horrifying plane crash in the last 10 years has been that PSA airliner over San Diego. Do you remember that? Maybe it was 8 years ago now. And some person in a small plane hit the plane, and it went into a steep dive. And I remember remember the picture of that thing? And almost straight up and down, just milliseconds before it crashed. And the last word on the flight recorder was, "Bye, Mom." His last thoughts were of his mother. It wasn't the big deal he had closed. It wasn't the awards he got. It wasn't the touchdowns he'd made in high school. What are you going to think about? Your stock portfolio? The invention that you made? Or will it be the faces of people? I've talked to people that have thought they were going to die and literally saw their life pass before their eyes. In a moment of heightened consciousness, everything, like time stood still and they could see it all. But what they thought about were the families, those golden moments that didn't seem like a big deal, rolling on the carpet with the kids, playing monster in the backyard, building a treehouse together, roller skating. And as you do those things, you begin to relive your own parents' lives because it takes you back to those back regions of your own life, and you remember playing monster with your dad or mom, as the case may be, or rolling on the carpet or whatever you did, and you become awed by the realization that before you even were fully conscious of who you are, before further back than your memory can take you, your folks knew you and loved you in spite of all the things that you did. You may think of those quiet moments with the spouse, those golden moments that make you forget all the tough times and the friction when you had those quiet walks together, when suddenly the channels were clear and unhindered and you felt those moments of intense intimacy. And the prodigal began to think about those things. He couldn't believe it, but his thoughts were turning home to Dad, the same Dad that nagged him and bugged him. He didn't think a whole lot about his brother. And yet, even his brother was part of the furniture. It was home. Maybe it wasn't all that bad after all. Now that he had two types of memories to reflect on, home and his wild living, he thought, you know, the wild living doesn't leave you with anything. But the home, the thing that I wanted to get away from, it turns out in reflection and hindsight to be the most important thing of all. And it meant so much to him that he began to think, maybe I actually need to go back. Oh, I couldn't do that. That's pretty far-fetched. Not after what I said to my dad. Not after I literally stole half of the inheritance to go out and squander it. Oh, my brother's going to give me grief. It'll never work. But you know, maybe, I know my dad's fair, I know he's just, maybe, just maybe, I could go back and get a job as one of the servants in the household. Yeah. I could do a whole lot worse than that. At least I'd hear the sound of my dad's voice. I'd see what he looks like. I'd hear the sounds of the family in there. That's what I think I'll do. Proverbs 27, the last one here. Like a bird that strays from its nest is a man who strays from his home. You think of birds, you think of nests. They got to land somewhere. They got to land in a nest. It's just the way God has made us. When you think of yourself, you should think at some level of home and family. It's where we were forged. It's where God intends us to live out our lives. It's the place to which we come back at the end of those day of those tough cultural enterprises. It's where God intends for us to make our greatest mark, and to abandon that home is to desert a trust, a charge, and a sacred responsibility. And it's to forfeit hope of having the greatest impact we could have on the future. Now, I know that this raises a question for singles. Singles means people who never were married, people who were formerly married. It could mean those who wanted to get married and didn't feel like they had an option, at least not one they could live with. It means certain people with various handicaps that prevent them from getting married or from having enough of the acquaintances that they can find someone that's suitable. It might even include somebody whose homosexual orientation makes it difficult for him or her to think of being able to carry out a family responsibility in that kind of relationship. It could be people whose relatives have died or whose families have rejected them. What about those people? Well, I just would put some questions to you as we're talking today. Do you have brothers and sisters? Do you have any parents still living? Are you still in touch with them? Is there anybody out there? Do you have friends? Are you just keeping up ties with them? I'm going to spend 4 or 5 weeks in October talking about friends, making them and keeping them. What about other Christians? And here I think Christianity has something so comforting and encouraging for us. When a person becomes a Christian, John 1:12 says, those who received Christ, God gave the right to become children of God. When a person really receives Christ into his life, God becomes his adoptive father. And he looks around, he says, hey, there are a lot of other people with an adoptive father that I've got. And, well, if we've got the same father, then I guess that makes us siblings, spiritual siblings, brothers and sisters. That's not just something you say at revival meetings. That's something that is really true deep down inside. One of the results of the fall into sin of Adam and Eve was the fracturing of the family. Adam and Eve started to spat at each other. And then you remember one of their sons, Cain, rose up and killed Abel. Now, one of the things that Christ has done when he comes into our lives is make it possible to rebind the human race together. God wanted the human race to be a family. Today, it's broken and fractured. But where we come together around the person of Jesus Christ, a sense of familyhood, familyness can be restored, and it's our calling to do that together. Let me suggest that you cultivate family life in the church. That's what we're about. One of our goals is to be a community. Not easy in this society, but it can be done. Let me go further and suggest that even if you are one, why not be a family of one? Why not make your house a home? Why not exercise hospitality? Why not open the door to other friends, especially to people who might be seeking a relationship with God? But just be a friend to people. God is a God who loves to reach out to others. Why not build bridges of friendship and invite them in? Maybe you'd want to make that home with other Christian friends. You could work on it together. It's okay. Jesus was never married. Paul spent most of his life not being married and actually wrote to the church in Corinth and said, you know, there's a lot of advantages to it. I remember hearing John Stott speak quite some years ago. Do y'all know who John Stott is? British speaker, Anglican preacher. He has an international ministry. He's one of these rare individuals who transcends all the barriers between conservative to ultra-liberal in the Christian community. And he knows people all over the world, and he is urbane. He is sophisticated. And I was at a college conference, and all the kids had one thing on their mind. Why aren't you married? How do you stand it? See, that's the question. As hormones raged through their bodies, they were really troubled by this. And Stott said, I never made a big decision not to get married. It wasn't a vow or anything. I even had an opportunity or two, but I just never did. And he reassured us that his drives were healthy and all the rest. But he said, you know, there are disadvantages to it in moments of loneliness. But at the same time, he said, I have friends all over the world that are far more intimate than many of my married friends are able or have the time to cultivate. Think about that. You've got opportunities there that married people don't have, and vice versa. At any rate, there are options, and God can show you what they are. The key thing is that we realize that the family is part of the good life. Some kind of family, some kind of connectedness. Relationships matter more than riches. The prodigal figured that out just in the nick of time. Some people never do. Some of us never do quite wake up to the importance of this until our parents die, or until we're estranged from our siblings, or our kids are grown and gone, or our marriage falls to pieces, or we live in the marriage but our wife or husband is a stranger. It's been years since we felt understood. The one thing for sure is that there's no good life without some kind of family life. In the end, I think it will shape the kind of person you become. I can't remember whether I read this to you or not, so I'm going to read it this morning. I know it was in my notes, but I don't think I took time a few weeks ago, and I want to read it to you this morning. Ben Patterson writing, quote, "Old age is when life has whittled us down, when joints have failed, skin is wrinkled, and capillaries have clogged and hardened, and what is left of us will be what we were all along in our essence. Exhibit A," he says, "a distant uncle who did nothing but find new ways to get rich, spends his last years in serenity, drooling and babbling constantly about the money he made. All that's left is raw greed. It's what he had cultivated in a thousand little ways over a lifetime. Exhibit B, his wife's grandmother, Ben Patterson's wife's grandmother. When she died in her mid-80s, she was already senile for several years. What did she talk about? When she was asked to pray before dinner, she'd reach out and hold the hands of those who were sitting next to her. A broad, beatific smile would spread across her face. Dim eyes would fill with tears as she looked up to heaven, and her chin would quaver as she literally poured out her love to Jesus. She couldn't even remember her family members' names, but she couldn't keep her hands from patting them lovingly whenever they got near her." You see the contrast? One whose life is invested in all the material things, all that's left for her was love for God and love for people. The most important step may be simply beginning in restoring a relationship with our Heavenly Father. And so I take you back where we began as we come around the last lap of the track here. Psalm 127, verse 1. Unless the Lord builds, unless the Lord watches. It's vain to try to have the good life without God in it. God is what good is all about. He defines good. He made us to be in relationship with Him. It's ludicrous and absurd to try to live a life that is good without God in it. I don't say it's easy to go back to God. I don't say that it's risk-free. It can be scary, especially if you've been hurt in the past, especially if God scares you, but it's the only way back. There may be some who think I've romanticized things, and I don't want to say that families are ideal. They're not. Mine isn't. Our neighbors will attest to that. So will my children and wife. I take some comfort from looking at the holy families in the Bible, like the family of Abraham. Did you ever read that story? Abraham lied to protect himself at his wife's expense. So did his son, picked up the same habit. That's what keeps me up at night. Then Jacob, his grandson, this guy had some real problems. He ended up marrying two women, and they were both sisters. You know a guy like that's missing a marble somewhere, don't you? And it created all these conflicts in his family that extended down to his children. One of his sons slept with his concubine. I won't explain what this guy was even doing with a concubine, unless maybe it's because he had these two sisters. Later, 10 of his sons sold one of his sons, Joseph, into slavery and covered it up for years and years. Another time, the boys in the family went out and massacred a whole other family because they had raped their sister, Dinah. And it goes on and on. And yet that is the holy family, ladies and gentlemen. Holy doesn't mean that we have achieved a performance standard in God's eyes. It means we have been cut out from the herd and God has a purpose. God didn't let them get away with that. He worked in their lives. And He never says that that stuff was okay. It wasn't. There are things that are wrong in our lives and our families, but grace means God can accept us in spite of those things because of what Jesus did in His life, death, and resurrection. So I would leave you with this. Ask God to guide you. Ask Him to build your family. Go to Him and have Him tell you what to do. I could give you five neat-sounding steps, a formula, but God has got to show you in your family what to do. The main thing is there is hope. If your family's in the ditch, it won't get out right away, but there's hope. There's hope over the long haul, and the long haul matters a whole lot more than the short haul. And it doesn't take forever to become a Christian. To establish a personal relationship with God is as simple as going to God and saying, God, I know that You're there, and I want You in my life. If you are willing to be honest about failure, willing to accept the gift of forgiveness instead of trying to earn it, a gift based upon what Jesus did in His life and death and resurrection history, if a person will simply ask Him to come into his life and believe in his heart and be willing to do whatever God asks with His help, God will come into his life. He'll come in and bring Himself because He Himself is the good life. Let's pray. Father in heaven, we thank you for our families. We thank you that they are only a reflection of the spiritual family that you intend in this world that will come to pass at the end of history when you intervene. Hard for us to believe, and yet we all long for that utopia where humankind is one big family. Let us taste a portion of that here in this church, in this fellowship. We pray for individual families, that you would strengthen them. And I pray especially this morning for any who, like the prodigal, are eating with the pigs and thinking, I am a long way from home, and I sense that home is where God is. Help them find their way back to you as you draw them to you. Help them to relinquish their hearts to you. Help them not to come bargaining with some new scheme and dream, but simply say, here I am, make of me what you will. Come into our lives, make us the people you want us to be, for we ask it in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.